The following program is brought to you by We Are Many. To learn more about this program or to find others like it, check out wearemany.org.
Thank you all. What an enthusiastic audience. I suppose Dave Zarin got you all excited. They will do that. So I'm really happy to be here. This is the second year I've been to the Socialist Conference. I really enjoyed last year. And since then, this book came out in January. And how many of you have read it? Oh, quite a few. Oh, good. It's been out long enough now that when I was first reading it, no one had read it, you know. So some of you can, you know, really challenge me if you have questions about the book and you've read it. I'm sure everyone would appreciate anything, because it's a very small book. It's in a series from City Lights Press. You know City Lights, the old beatnik press in San Francisco, is pretty much that. And they have an editor, Greg Ruggiero, who does this public media series, and they do, you know, well, different sized books, but like they did a pamphlet by Mumia. It's 35 pages. I think something by Noam Chomsky is about 300 pages. And so this is short, you know, but it's a little more for public, you know, issues that are current. So, as we know, guns are a constant topic. So, I have a little different take than, you know, I kind of skirt the issue of gun control as such. I think it's pretty unlikely to happen until there's a change in consciousness about militarism and gun violence, and there's a historical a reason for that until that's acknowledged and faced up to, and what the Second Amendment was really about. And white nationalists know very well what it's really about, but most liberals don't. You know, they think it's about hunting. Not about hunting. That's what I wanted to call the book. It's not about hunting. Although there is a chapter on the myth of the hunter in here, but because hunting is a kind of culty thing that again is sort of play acting like Indians never really were themselves. I always say, you know, Indians were, they brought the animals to them. You know, they had deer parks and brought them close. They didn't go tromping out, you know, in the mud to hunt down a deer. They attracted them to the succulents they planted around their villages. So it's a whole mythology that's a problematic in itself. But in the early 1970s, approximately half of all homes in the United States contained a firearm. Personal firearm, 112 million in total. And that was about the population of the United States in the 1970s. And nearly a half century later, only a third of households have a firearm. It's actually decreased. However, there are more firearms than population in the United States, including babies, the whole population, 300 million. There are more firearms in civilian hands than there are people. But only a third of the population even has one firearm. So the number of guns privately owned, at the average of each gun owner is 8 weapons, 8 each. So when someone says, yeah, they were for self-protection. Well, why do you need 8? Especially, you know, if they're AR-15, you need 8 of them, you know. 8 weapons. So so really there's a gun fetish, gun hoarding taking place. So who are these gun hoarders? U.S. civilians own, by the way, U.S. civilians own 50% of the world's privately owned firearms. We're 4% of the world's population. We own 50%. So it is significant that 74% of gun owners in the United States are men, and 82% of all gun owners are white, which means that 61% of all adults who own guns are white men. And this demographic accounts for only 31% of the total U.S. population. So, what are the majority of white men so afraid of? Does anyone believe that centuries of racial and economic domination by white men have left no traces in our culture, views, or institutions? So the ongoing influence of this history is compounded by the lack of knowledge and the acknowledgement of the colonists' savage violence across the continent that continued until the 20th century and total colonization of the indigenous peoples, as well as the legacies of legalized racial slavery following emancipation. So vocal gun rights advocates and gun control advocates, both groups predominantly white and affluent, have little basis for communicating. Gun ownership appears irrational, if not insane, to gun control advocates in most of the world, while gun lovers rely on the Second Amendment because they have no other argument for owning 8 or more firearms and don't wish to admit, perhaps even to themselves, what the Second Amendment signifies. Neither party seems to have any idea of what the Second Amendment was originally about. But I think those hardcore gun owners know very well what it's about and what they're afraid of. So I'll repeat again that this thing about hunting is really a clueless argument that liberals make, and I hope you'll tell all your very sincere gun control advocate friends, don't say you don't need an AR-15 to shoot a deer. It's embarrassing because that's not what people get AR-15s for. They do go shoot things, I mean shoot anything that moves, but that's not what they get them for. And actually, the early British settlers, as well as post-independence rural white settlers, used domesticated animals for food, very little for wild games. Nearly all their hunting was commercial for the huge, lucrative global capitalist fur trade. And mostly, they used trapping rather than firearms, taking the skins and leaving the dead animal to rot. Gun use, that's your Daniel Boone, the commercial fur trade. Gun use was neither recreational nor necessary for food. Guns were to kill Indians. So the National Rifle Association has around 5 million dues-paying members and many millions more who support the NRA for legislative action and calls for legislative action. Their annual budget is $300 million, only 10% of which goes to direct lobbying. The NRA does very little lobbying. There's no such thing as a gun lobby, really, but rather follows and grades every political candidate, local, state, and federal, on gun rights and puts out a call to their membership to support or campaign against candidates accordingly, local, state, municipal, federal. focusing on states and local, though, not the federal government. And that's where most of the gun laws are made, where gun rights activists tend to focus on Congress, relying on, you know, Congress, federal action, rather than fighting where the laws are actually made. So the NRA has active affiliates in many communities, almost every congressional district in the United States, with an average membership as 100,000 per state. The NRA has become, in the past 40 years, a right-wing membership organization with a popular base. So instead of dismissing the Second Amendment as antiquated and irrelevant, or as not actually meaning what it says, which gun advocates, gun rights advocates argue, understanding the original purpose of the Second Amendment is really key to understanding gun culture of the United States, and possibly the key to a new consciousness about gun violence. So the Second Amendment of the U.S. Constitution is a simple statement: a well-regulated militia being necessary to the security of a free state, the right of the people to keep and bear arms shall not be infringed. So the NRA and its constituency argue that the Second Amendment guarantees the right for every individual to bear arms without regulations, while gun control advocates maintain that the Second Amendment is about states continuing to have their own militias, emphasizing the language of well-regulated. And they say this is manifest in the existence of the National Guard. But that's not the case. The state militias that became the National Guard were already authorized in the Constitution itself. When the amendments were drawn up, there would be no reason to put it in a Bill of Individual Rights when it already existed in the Constitution itself. So the Constitution recognized the existing colonial that became the state militias that later became the National Guard. And during the War for Independence, this was done, you know, this transfer. And they mandated them to play vital roles and to execute the laws of the Union, suppress insurrections, and repel invasions. And the President of the United States can always call, as Trump did recently, call on National Guards for federal duty, or like they do, calling National Guard to go to fight their wars in Afghanistan and Iraq. So given now what our state's National Guards are descended from state militias, which were repurposed from colonial militias, why was the Second Amendment added as one of the enumerated rights of man in the Bill of Rights? And who were these militias? Well, unequivocally, the Second Amendment, along with the other nine amendments, constituted individual rights. That's what it is. It's a Bill of Individual Rights. And the militias referenced are voluntary and self-organized, not state militias. It's funny to me when liberals argue that somehow the state would have to be involved for it to be well-regulated, rather than, well, self-regulated. These settlers had motives for killing Indians and for slave patrols. I get it, to the slave patrols. And that was to take the land and maintain. It was in, that's settler democracy. They were very good at self-organizing to do that. And we all know we self-organize all the time. Maybe not very well, but not as well as they do. But human beings do that without the state necessarily being involved. So just that implication that couldn't possibly mean that the state is not involved, but in fact, these are individual liberties. So one argument that runs through the historical accounts of the thinking behind the Second Amendment is idealizing Anglo settler farmers as fiercely independent and fearing Big Brother government, insisting on settlers' right to insurrection, an argument now being taken up even by some anti-racist white groups like the Redneck Revolt and John Brown Gun Club. But what Anglo settlers considered oppressive was any restriction that British authorities put on them in regard to obtaining land and owning slaves. In the instance that's almost always used as an example of this is Bacon's Rebellion in 1676, which is a rarely explained as it happened. A very wealthy member of the Virginia colonial government, Nathaniel Bacon, was wanted to expand into further into Indian territory, and actually got a lot of landless white farmers and some former indentured servants. And at that time, that was just before, you know, the racial codes were instituted, there were quite a few freedmen, African-derived indentured servants without land. So he organized them to go in and attack the Indians and take their lands against the colony's wishes, and they got beaten terribly. But their whole goal was to take more Indian land, you know, hardly a valiant pursuit. So they rebelled against their own colonial government to take land for themselves. So what the United States really instituted was the settlers' rights to do that, and then you know, what happens over and over, then the governments come in, later the corporations too, and they lose that land, the poor losers. I come from my father's family, from these poor losers who from Kentucky, you know, Virginia to Kentucky, then on to Missouri, where Daniel Boone died, by the way. They follow the track of Daniel Boone, and at least some of them, like my father's family, end up in Oklahoma with land taking from Indians and then lose it, and they're tenant farmers. And I grew up, my father was a tenant farmer. And that happened over and over. So they lose it, but they're really foot soldiers of empire. You know, they're dupes. That's what they have to understand. They're being duped all the time because the racial code allows them the white supremacy. They're not afraid of the demographics, they're afraid of the loss of white supremacy, white dominance. So historian Charles Sellers wrote, quote, cheap land held absolutely under the seaboard market's capitalist conception of property swelled patriarchal honor to heroic dimensions in rural America. The father's authority rested on his legal title to the family land, where European peasant holdings were usually encumbered with obligations to some elite, the American farmer held in fee simple. Supreme in his domain, he was beyond interference by any earthly power. Fee simple land, the augmenting theater of the patriarchal persona, sustained his honor and untrammeled will. The extraordinary independence inflated American farmers' conception of their class far above peasantry. So don't let anyone, there's a whole new book out, I can't think of the author's name, but he theorizes, he's actually a kind of Marxist writer, historian, that all these settlers were really made up of peasantry, puts them in the class of peasantry. Don't ever believe that. They're aspirate capitalism, not peasants. So the Second Amendment thus reflects this dependence on individual armed men, not just in terms of their right to bear arms, but early on in the colonies, it was a requirement to bear arms. So the violent appropriation of native land by white settlers was seen as an individual right in the Second Amendment, second only to freedom of speech. Male colonial settlers had long formed militias for the purpose of raiding and razing indigenous communities and seizing their lands, resources, and native communities fought back. Virginia, the first colony, forbade any man to travel unless he was, quote, well armed. A few years later, another law required men to take arms with them to work and to attend church or be fined. In 1658, the colony ordered every settler home to have a functioning firearm, and later even provided government loans for those who could not afford to buy a weapon. Similarly, New England colonial governments made laws such as the 1632 requirement that each person have a functioning firearm plus 2 pounds of gunpowder and 10 pounds of bullets. Householders were fined for missing or defective arms and ammunition. No man was to appear in public, a public meeting, including church, unarmed. Were they fighting bears? Who were they afraid of? Who was out there, you know, it's their land, that trying to get the land back that had been stolen from them? The Indians. So all of that, when historians read this and, you know, they disappear the Indians, like, oh, well, they must have needed to kill bears or, you know, something, some predator or something. Oh, one Supreme Court judge said, or maybe Indians. John Stevens, he's the only one that got caught. Maybe they were wanting to protect themselves from the savage Indians. Yes, that was it. So these laws stayed on the books in the earliest colonies and were created in new colonies as they were founded. So the Second Amendment, ratified in 1791, enshrined these rights and obligations as constitutional law. So the continuing significance of what is specified in the Bill of Rights reveals the settler colonial's culture roots, settler colonial democracy, especially after Andrew Jackson, those roots of the United States that appear even in the present as a sacred right. Several of the colonies had declared independence in 1776. Several of those colonies, they all did, the 13. But several of them, Massachusetts, New Hampshire, New Jersey, Pennsylvania, Vermont, and Virginia, already, if you remember your History 101, that they first rebelled as independent sovereign states. Virginia was a commonwealth. Massachusetts was a commonwealth. They each were governments, and they made a confederation of independent states. They had maps mapped all the way to the Pacific, where Maine would be where Salem, Oregon is now, Salem, Massachusetts to Salem, Oregon. They had these maps they had already drawn out, you know, these maps to take the continent. But each were separate states, so it was what the Constitution did was create the federal government and then states' rights. But several of these colonies, when they declared their independence, actually had the Second Amendment already in their state constitutions. And of course, Thomas Jefferson and Madison of Virginia were the main authors of the constitutional one. So they had already adopted individual gun rights measures in their state constitutions. So they simply transferred it. The reason there's no, there's little documentation on the Second Amendment is there was no argument about it. It was just taken for granted. It was not controversial at all that was settlers' rights. So we have to look at that. Why has the United States remained so violent when colonialism has been violent everywhere. Colonial genocide, and when compared to other countries, the United States has no more violent than, let's say, the Belgian Congo or Australia, where the Tasmanian indigenous people were hunted as sport until they were all killed off by the Australian settlers, British settlers. Horrible, grotesque genocides. The United States is right in there. They don't admit it. You know, Australians actually apologized, at least, for genocide. We don't admit it. It doesn't get into our textbooks or anything, even with Native resistance. So the conquests in Africa, Asia, the Caribbean, South America, the United States was not exceptional in the sheer amount of violence it imposed to achieve sovereignty over the territories it appropriated. And the British colonizations of Canada, Australia, and New Zealand were equally genocidal, equally settler colonialism. But one thing they didn't have, what did those other countries not have that the United States had? Chattel slavery. Okay, so that is the other inseparable part that I'll get to in a minute. But I have to quote to get back a little bit to the Wild West. Wyoming Senator Alan Simpson. Do you all know who he is? Okay. He put it succinctly, without guns, there would be no West, adding that his grandfather had settled in the Wyoming Territory 2 years before Custer's defeat by the Sioux and the Cheyenne Nations at Little Bighorn. The West, of course, is a metaphor for the continent as it began on the Atlantic seaboard. But in this interview, Simpson was not only speaking historically about what the guns were for, to kill Indians, always the implied enemy, in order to seize more land, he was promoting gun rights in the present. It was an interview about, and he's a proud NRA member. He pointed out in another interview that in Wyoming, how steady you hold your rifle, that's gun control in Wyoming. So here Simpson reveals, when firearms are no longer needed to appropriate indigenous people's lands, the firearm becomes a representation of ongoing colonial genocide and colonial racial domination, a kind of war trophy, like the sports team's mascots or the naming war weapons of war after Indians or operations like killing Obama. Osama bin Laden under Obama, and naming it Geronimo. Geronimo is dead. That's what they said when they called in to President Obama, and Geronimo. So these war trophies, this fetishism, the gun fetish is very related to this fetishism of trophy, you know, taking trophies in warfare. So I want to talk about the how the NRA became a white nationalist organization. So the genealogy of the ascension of constitutional originalism, I don't know, you probably read some about this and lately this packing the court, you know, the court will be a great majority of originalists. So originalism means going back and reading, you know, it's like the church I grew up in, the Southern Baptist, that every word is true in the Bible, everything it says. Absolutely you have to figure out exactly what is meant by every word, but and there are different interpretations, but you have to get to the original meaning. Well, here we are, you know, then looking back at a bunch of slave owners that wrote a constitution and saying we have to think exactly like they did at the time. Is that right? So a counter-revolution took form. After the Supreme Court decision to desegregate schools, they made arguments of states' rights, anti-communism, trying to portray the civil rights movement as communist. And in Oklahoma, where I grew up, rural Oklahoma, signs went up everywhere. Impeach Earl Warren. He was the Supreme Court justice, the Chief Justice of the Supreme Court that decided the desegregation decision of 1953, Brown versus Board of Education. So out of that came very quickly the John Birch Society that organized around impeach Earl Warren. So it was really a counter-revolution that immediately took place with that. I call it an earthquake that happened to white dominance. The civil rights movement, of course, the NAACP was founded in 1901. W.B. Du Bois, he's still alive and you know, working on the court case that was brought went to the Supreme Court. So it's not as if the civil rights movement just fell from the sky, you know, or they just were being generous. It was very clear there was going to be a revolution in the United States. It was going to build up to that, and not only that, it made the United States look about as bad as apartheid South Africa with Jim Crow. So they had to jump on it, you know, the powers that be, and get ahead of the game and try to fend off the militancy. And of course, Jim Crow didn't just disappear, but there we have to look at that counter-revolution that started at that time. We get confused genealogically because we had this great radical revolution, anti-war movement and black power and red power and everything in the 60s, you know, so it kind of dims the counter-revolution that had already started and just really, really fed off the 60s. Everything we were doing, it was just, you know, just building up their own until, wow, one day Ronald Reagan gets elected to the presidency, and he's very much pushed in the John Birch Society. They started organizing on a very local level, and this is what the NRA started doing too. They called it kitchen table politics, mainly using women, and of course the evangelical movement were, you know, white evangelicals were pulled into this too at this in the 70s. So the John Birch Society was birthed in 1958 in Massachusetts, but these were very wealthy people, like Fred Koch. You've heard of the Koch brothers. Well, their dad was one of the charter members of the John Birch Society. So, you know, they're a white nationalist funding organization now, out of Wichita, Kansas. So what they really tried to do is shrink government that would give any kind of reparations or empowerment to the black population or to Native people, any kind of self-determination or to, you know, Latinos. There was an attitude of reparations, of repairing this that came out of the 60s movement. But at the same time, these people wanted to shrink government, and that was their idea that, you know, the free market and small government and everything being privatized, that way there would be no public goods to give support for the empowerment of the oppressed peoples, or poor peoples, or trade unions they have attacked too, and they practically have destroyed them. A recent decision of the Supreme Court, as you know, took away the ability of unions to collect dues from slackers that feed off of everything that we fight for. Then they get the benefits too, but they don't want to pay the dues, right? So this highly public reassertion of white supremacy and the Birch Society's methods of founding activist local chapters to first take over school boards and other local offices across the country became a hallmark of the New Right movement. That's why they own Congress, both houses of Congress, the Supreme Court, and the presidency now. They worked very hard for this. And the National Rifle Association itself was transformed during this time. It was never benign. I mean, it was benign. It was kind of benign. I mean, it was never against some gun control. They testified before Congress to ban the sale of Tommy guns to Thompson machine guns that came out of First World War for civilian use because of the gangs in New York. I mean, in Chicago. it was here. So, you know, because the outlaws had the guns, Pretty Boy Floyd had a Thompson machine gun, the FBI killed him. So that was they testified in favor of that, you know, in favor of gun control. They never had intervened. In the 60s, they were testifying against gun control, although they certainly supported the legislation in California that banned Black Panthers from having weapons on public weapons. So not only were Euro-Americans losing dominance, but you have to see this in a global sense too, coinciding with the height of the civil rights movement and the other people's movements. It was also this period, 1954 to 64, and it went on after 64, but really intensely 54 to 64, national liberation movements in Africa, Asia, Latin America, and the Caribbean. The United Nations was basically set up for decolonization. It was set up for decolonization. And so this was all done through a United Nations process. And most of these national liberation movements, they had to fight, but they evicted the Algerians, evicted the French, the Vietnamese evicted the French, but the United States took over. Congo and others got rid of the Belgians, the Dutch, the Portuguese, and British colonizers from their country. Some went on for a long time, like Rhodesia, what's now Zimbabwe, not until 1980. And some never did, like Puerto Rico, get independence. So these movements inspired African Americans, Puerto Ricans, indigenous peoples, Chicanos, Asian Americans, as a, you know, being part of liberation movements around the world. It was a global feeling of we're in this period, you know, now the 60s, remembering the 60s, and you have to remember that in the mix. It wasn't just France. It was, what we then called the Third World. And so this fear of loss of white supremacy was larger than just, you know, the white supremacy domestically, but looking around the world, the loss of a possible loss of United States dominance in the Third World, supremacy in the world, and among the elite, a loss of confidence in capitalism, because almost all of these national liberation movements, I would say all of them, were socialist. In their perspective, they were national liberation movements. They were nationalists, but they had, you know, like African socialism. They were socialist-minded. This was terrifying, you know, to the capitalists, and the United States kind of held the reins of the capitalist world. So the National Rifle Association was one of the formations that was transformed during this period. And this is how it happened. By the time of the 1977 NRA convention, the right-wing Second Amendment Foundation and its lobbying arm, the Citizens Committee for the Right to Keep and Bear Arms, which were founded in Washington State in 1974, they seized leadership in the NRA. And how did they do that? The NRA is a nonprofit. A lot of you know what nonprofits are. Okay, I am a kind of passive member of a nonprofit, being a member of the AAA. Some of you may have the automobile club thing. You get a few perks, you know, you get cheaper insurance, you get, you know, road service, and they come and fill your gas tank if you run out of gas and stuff like that. But they send me, you know, once a year to vote on who's in charge, and I throw it in the trash. Well, that's what most of the 5 million members of the NRA do, because they want the discount on their ammunition, or they want, you know, the little perks. There used to be a lot of corporate perks, like AAA. I can get 10% discount on almost any hotel with my AAA card. They could do that with their NRA card. But most of them pull out, most of these corporations. Interesting, after Parkland. And the person in charge of that, who founded that organization, was a man named Harlan Carter. His career path came, that's very relevant at this time. He was a U.S. border chief. As a youth, he had killed a fellow teenager who was a Mexican and was sentenced to 3 years in prison. It was overturned after that, but he aspired to kill more Mexicans, so he joined the Border Patrol. What ICE is now used to be called the Border Patrol. And he became the head of it. And he was the one that instrumentalized and made happen a national program called Operation Wetback. Have you heard of Operation Wetback? That's the slur term, that's the N-word for Mexicans, wetback. You know, they swim across the Rio Grande River. And that's what it was called. Legislatively, it was called Operation Wetback. This was a violent, corrupt, racist, and massive roundup deportation of people who were allegedly undocumented Mexicans, most of whom were citizens of the United States. And this is the man that took over the NRA and made it a white nationalist organization with the core of it. But still today, you know, there are these 5 million members. Probably there are no more than 10,000 hardcore. They may be multiplying, you know, as the white nationalists are gaining a lot of traction with Trump in power. So that's how the NRA became the largest and most important and powerful white nationalist legitimate non-profit organization. They don't even have to pay taxes in the United States. And that's how it has to be seen. Because I hear people waffling and say, well, there are a lot of good people who are members of the NRA. They're not like that. Well, they should leave. Because they are in a white nationalist organization. So it's like that.
The preceding program was a production of WeAreMany.org, a website dedicated to publishing radical and activist media that promotes a better understanding of today's world while also putting forward a vision for a better future. We Are Many is a project of the Center for Economic Research and Social Change. To learn more about this program or to find others like it, check out WeAreMany.org.